good afternoon. She introduced me already. I'll be discussing the effects of transition to electronic health records on the management of pelvic inflammatory disease in adolescents. This research took place in a large academic institution in Baltimore, Maryland, and I work with Ms. Sherry Stevens Gibson under the mentorship of Dr. Maria Trent. We declare that we have no personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation. In the United States, the earlier presenter told us in her background, healthcare institutions have been encouraged to transition to electronic health records, and this is important and it is good. It's to take advantage of information technology to improve patient care. However, there is a need to evaluate this transition and see if there's any effect on the standards of care being given to patients. And we have decided, we decided to work on pelvic inflammatory disease because in the United States, among women of reproductive age group, this is one of the commonest reasons where women visit emergency rooms. And we're focusing on adolescents because they appear to at higher risk to be at higher risk of developing sexually transmitted infections, which might develop into pelvic inflammatory disease. And if this happens to them, it puts them at risk of having tubal scarring in their future, and this can lead to infertility, and it can also lead to ectopic pregnancies. In 2004, the academic institution where the research took place is Johns Hopkins University, Baltimore, Maryland, and they did a study on what happens to adolescents being managed for pelvic inflammatory disease in their pediatric ambulatory care unit, and they found out that only about 62% of patients that were managed for pelvic inflammatory disease got the standard medication as recommended by CDC. So they did a paper-based quality improvement. They put a paper-based quality improvement protocol in place. And following this, they found out that there was an improvement to 91% of patients actually receiving standard medication as recommended by CDC. So it is in the background of this paper-based protocol that transitioned to electronic health record took place in this hospital. And so what our study is now doing is to evaluate the effect of this transition from the paper-based post-quality assurance protocol to an integrated health electronic health record system. So what we're doing is that what happens to the standard of care these adolescents are receiving for pelvic inflammatory disease, did the transition to health record make any difference? Is there an improvement? Is there a fall in the standard of care? And what we've done is that we did a retrospective review of medical records, and we have two groups in our sampling. We have 66 patients, from post the quality paper-based quality improvement procedure, and then we have 44 from records following electronic health record transition in 2009. And our charts, how we extracted our information is using charts identified by ICD-9 codes, and then we used a standardized form extraction form. Data was analyzed using logistic regression and chi-square analysis. I just have this slide on here to show you information in the standardized data extraction form. However, for the purpose of this presentation, we'll be concentrating on location of care. We are dealing with outpatient care. We're going to look at the medical regimen received and if they had a minimum diagnostic criteria documented on the charts, because there are two things here. Did the patient receive the standard standard regimen as recommended by CDC, and did they have the minimum diagnostic criteria as recommended by CDC for the diagnosis of pelvic inflammatory disease documented on their chart? So that's what we're looking at in this research. So that we're on the same page, this is the CDC guideline for diagnosis of pelvic inflammatory disease. In sexually active young women, if they have low abdominal pain or pelvic pain, for which no other cause can be identified in association to any of the other three signs, cervical motion tenderness, uterine tenderness, and adnexia tenderness. So we're looking to see if any of this is documented in the chart before a diagnosis of pelvic inflammatory disease was made. This is the CDC guideline. It's just for completeness of this presentation. This is the CDC guideline for the management of pelvic inflammatory disease. But like I told you earlier, we're focusing on, did they receive the standard medication as recommended by CDC? And this is, we have, this is a recommended combination of medications that CDC has recommended. So these are the combination of drugs that we're looking, we're going into the charts to look at to find out, did they receive this combination that will take care of the empirical organisms that normally cause pelvic inflammatory disease? So I'll hand over to Ms. Gibson to tell us about the results.
And our second presenter is Sherry Stevens Gibson, who completed her undergraduate studies at the University of Southern Mississippi. She completed graduate studies at Jackson State University and is currently a doctoral student in the DRPH program, and her interests focus on stroke awareness and education.
Good afternoon. And the average age for the pre-electronic health record group was 16.7 and 17.2 for the post-electronic health record group. The majority of participants were predominantly African American and insured by Medicaid. And the minimum criteria documented in the chart for the pre-electronic health record group was 83% and 93.1% for the post. When we look at the pre-electronic health record group, 9.1% of these patients did not receive the standard medication regimen, compared to 23.3% of patients in the post group who did not receive the standard medication regimen. And based on logistic regression, adolescents in the post-electronic health record group were less likely to receive the standard medication regimen. The odds ratio is 0.330, with a 95% confidence interval ranging from 0.110 to 0.989, and the p-value was 0.048. This is just a visual for you to actually look at the non-standard treatment. We can see that after the electronic health record system was implemented, that it actually increased from 9.1% to 23.3%. And when we look at the minimum criteria documented in the chart, we can see where it increased from 83% to 93.1%. So the use of an integrated post system may result in better documentation, but without interactive aid to clinical decision making, care may not meet national standards. So therefore, there are additional strategies to ensure provider adherence to national guidelines are warranted. This study had a few limitations. This study was conducted in an institution-based urban setting. Therefore, the results may not be applicable to rural areas or suburban areas. Also, there may be potential for other unmeasured factors contributing to the findings. So, what is Johns Hopkins Medicine doing to improve care? We have a list of steps that they are taking. The first, better care through checklists. The checklist is designed to help caregivers provide proper steps when delivering care, also to improve patient outcomes. Decreasing emergency room wait time. Across the United States, there's a problem with walkouts, people entering the emergency room and leaving without being seen. So in 2006, the Hopkins Hospital Emergency Department developed a new triage system, and it has decreased walkouts by one-third. Safety dashboards. They chart progress in addressing areas of focus, such as improving the timely use of antibiotics. And this provides a feedback loop to the unit so they can see the effects of their actions. And it also develops a culture that is more sensitive to safety for the patient. Communication and teamwork training. Across healthcare, communication failures among providers is a leading cause of patient harm. So the hospital adapted the interpersonal communications training modeled on the aviation industry, which has reduced communication-related causes of plane crashes. And finally, the computerized provider order entry, or better known as POL. This is a computerized system for ordering medications, lab tests, and also other specialty services. This system also decreases the risk of transcription errors and other problems that may be associated with handwritten orders. It also includes alerts for drug interactions, drug allergies, and dosage errors. And this system is implemented in the outpatient clinic as well as the inpatient units. And this is just an example of the PID poll order set. It's a very unique order set because it actually provides feedback to the user. If you notice in the middle of the screen, it has a question, was the patient education sheet reviewed with the patient and a copy provided? If the provider checks no, there's information in the drop-down box that says review discharge patient education sheet, and it provides a link for the provider, and it also reminds them to print a copy to give to the patient as well. So our results showed that there was a significant difference between the pre and post electronic health record groups when we looked at the standard medication regimen. So there is a need to ensure paper protocols transition to easy-to-use interactive electronic documents and to conduct ongoing quality assurance activities as technology is increasingly implemented into the medical environment. And we'd like to thank you. We would also, we'd like to acknowledge our mentor, Dr. Maria Trent. She is an associate professor of pediatrics and adolescent medicine at Johns Hopkins University, and also Dr. Harolyn Belcher. She is the program director for the RISE program at Kenny Krieger Institute, and Ms. Janice McFadden. She is the program manager.
I don't want to be the first one to ask a question, but I have a question. Let's see. We have, oh, well, it's 10 after 1. I don't know when we have to leave. 1:30? We have plenty of time. Question?
Was there any look at, do you think that provider knowledge base for PID treatment was a factor in the increased rate of not using the CDC guidelines, treatment guidelines for the treatment of PID? In the paper chart, it's harder to, you know, track what people are doing. But when you go to electronic health records, you click. So you only do one click or two clicks. You know, was it just that their knowledge base was not sufficient enough or adequate enough to why you saw that increase in the number of mistreated PID patients?
When you looked at before the electronic health records came in, yes, like you said, the knowledge base is an important factor. But however, because they had like a paper-based protocol, so it had the paper had like checklists and things that directed the physician on what to do and what other healthcare providers should do. But it didn't immediately those checklists and stuff did not immediately translate when the electronic health record came in. However, at the moment now, that has been done following the research. But what if they had the checklist in place in the electronic health records, immediately the transition took place, it would have helped. Because, you know, like what she showed us in the middle of the screen, if there's a prompt to tell the physician to do certain things, so that will help to keep the standard. So that's like one of the things we observed. Did I answer your question? Okay. Yes, while you're seeing the patients, those questions and promptings come up.
Right. So Dr. Trent is kind of a great clinical observer, and she has actually several different studies on PID, and has, from the old school, when we used to keep young ladies in the hospital for 10 or 15 days, she did a study that looked at this transition to just giving PO medication and sending them back. That and seeing that a lot of those young ladies would be coming back. So she developed a kind of a hip hop video that talked about why
How are orders being implemented before the physician order entry system came on board? So when you just had the electronic medical record, were they there were still handwritten orders?
Yeah, there were orders, and what the difference now in the system now is that there are prompts to make sure that everything is being done. You know, like initially it's just you have your electronic interface and then the physician puts in his notes and makes his prescriptions and all that. But now there are prompts to make sure that required things take place, to find out, okay, did the patient get the patient note? Did you discuss this and all that with the patient?
Yes. No, they weren't. We used a standalone personal health record. I said it was created by the provider. It was used in the diabetes clinic, but it had not backed in to Amalga, which is our organization-wide electronic medical record. So it was basically just being used in the diabetes clinic. On the Health Vault platform.
And then you discussed also the
apps
that now have QTARs.
It's quite a jungle out there. So, for instance, we were interested in the iPhone because for some reason clinicians really like this thing. And if you know anything about Apple and Microsoft, they don't like each other. So there is no app for Health Vault on the iPhone. There is for Google Health. It's a wonderful interface. It's beautiful. It's standards-based. It has continuity of care. The technology, the interchange technology that will ultimately help people transfer information between PHRs and EMRs, EHRs, is these continuity of care records and continuity of care documents. I think it's a continuity of care document. It's a subset of HL7. Unfortunately, it doesn't work with the iPhone, and we really wanted to do something that a physician would be receptive to. I skipped over it, but we had a great deal of difficulty getting people in outpatient offices to look at anything that the patient brought. We finally had to do. They didn't want to transfer any electronic information. They couldn't do it. We would finally end up printing out the records, which they appreciated, but never really understood what that meant, that the patient was coming in with their records already in hand, so they didn't have to transcribe it. Anything else? Yeah.
So with the outpatient camera, are they pretty much looking at these printed records and saying, okay, that's nice? Did you feel like they didn't really...
I think I see a commonality here is there's no process in place to deal with this record. And so you're it's not emergent. You have a process, and you don't know what to do with this patient who's coming in and offering you something different. You don't have any way of receiving it. There has been a few studies. They're starting to appear in the literature of patient-generated data and the effect that that's going to have on healthcare efficiency. Not everything a patient brings you is useful, and the healthcare providers who have to maintain a process are not interested in accepting just anything from a patient. I think that's the barrier. In an emergent situation, however, it's completely different. The entire experience is different. So in the emergency room, they're very, very glad to get anything they could from this patient.
Is there ever any documentation or studies on false information that was somehow put in the patient? Maybe they were, impaired thought process? Or
I haven't read any studies to that effect where that actually happened, but I know that that's a huge issue of contention, and one of the reasons that I don't think very quickly we're going to see patients being able to enter much information into their electronic health records because it just partially because of that problem. But the other side of that is that then the patient can't go in and correct it. Some formats have been proposed where the patient can annotate, and surely then the healthcare provider can look at what's there and look at the patient's annotation and then make a considered decision, which is, you know, what you have to do anyway. Yes.
Just on the matter of security, I know that PHR is not covered under HIPAA. If you voluntarily store them, you know, their information, it's there, set here it is. So as far as security, how is that being secured? I mean, we hear about leaks on the HIPAA violations.
It's exactly the same. I think the ONC, they had a workshop last fall on PHRs, and this issue came up. And there was a lot of discussion about having the PHR providers actually be like business associates under HIPAA. So that's kind of still out there. But the analogy is if the patient prints out their record, you can go to your provider and get a printed copy of your record. It's hard, but it's your right. And you leave it on the bus. Whose fault is that? It's the same premise. What we found in working with people with disabilities, there's one study I found. It's actually it's a PhD. It's Deborah Lafke's PhD dissertation, and she is right now. She actually works at ONC at the moment. People with disabilities have a very different approach to security and privacy. It's a different culture surrounding those issues than, say, people who primarily identify as having a chronic illness. Now, this is a Venn diagram. They overlap. But what comes out of focus groups and key informant interviews with people with disabilities is privacy is a secondary issue, and security is a secondary issue. They want accurate information so they don't die. And another interesting thing is employment is a huge factor. People who are employed are much more worried about security than people who are not employed. Well, yeah, you're afraid somebody's going to use your information. Our diabetes population does not want their information shared with anybody. Many of them want to hide that they have diabetes. So, I don't know if that answers it. There is no answer, I guess. It's contentious.
I just wondered if that is in some way inhibiting the use of, you know, the HR.
Well, yeah, I did, and there've been several surveys. It depends on who you are. For the population at large, that is an issue. For folks with disabilities, it's not an issue. It's possible, and that was actually my interest is that it seemed like it was a perfect niche. But the situations that people with disabilities want to manage are pretty few, and it really hinges on the ability of the systems to be able to talk to each other, and they really don't do that yet. Sorry, going on and on.
Validity.
thinking and taking the time to understand what it is that they're doing and why they're doing it. And I think that that can lead to even more health outcomes.
I think I agree with you that it will be something to look at to find out if there's actually everything that is being seeked is actually what is being done. But I also want us to look at it this way, that because we have prompts that remind people to do what they're supposed to do, so even when they forget to do it, there's something. So for someone who is committed to the patient, there's a drive to do what you're supposed to do. Now, there's another problem, whether the person is just ticking. But if you're a physician and you're actually committed to making sure that your patient gets the best care, I think it will be a help. So, but I think it's an interesting thing to look at, to see the correlation between the ticking and the actual...
Did you plan to do any type of qualitative follow-up study to see, I mean... to see what happened. I mean, it seems kind of, it was everybody saying, it seems obvious that people assumed that people would maintain their usual practice with the checklist and the documentation, and then they didn't.
I mean,
follow-up study to see what, I mean, it seems clear that they didn't, that whoever implemented the EMR didn't realize that people would drop this other part of the process.
Mm-hmm. And well, right now I'm sure
it sounds like your follow up. I mean, with the communications and the checklist and everything, that's going to address that.
Sorry. It would be nice to document that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That whole industry is just going away because of the security loophole. It's really funny. So you had a question. Okay, we,
So they're saying, oh yeah, I'm sure they did this, and it won't match up with the record. So we're trying to find a way to word the question so it doesn't sound like it doesn't feel like you're gonna get your doctor fired or anything, because that's definitely not what we're looking at. We just wanna find a way to improve the system. We've also found that sometimes the electronic health record, because it's a system, it takes you through these little steps that are unnecessary, because you always end up with these situations where you're like, okay, I don't need to do that, just click out of it. And it gets to the point where it's frustrating. Some of them have those break the glass ceilings in there where you're going to go into their psych record. And even though it's all one patient, you're trying to go through all these different things and re-enter your number, your password and everything. And sometimes I think that adds to confusion versus just writing on paper, or when you just go back and put things on the chart.
We haven't kind of gotten to Star Trek yet. We just, you know, to go and it takes time. It takes actually longer to use the electronic health record than it does to write something.
Or dealing with people that put things in log notes on people's charts, because if it's in a log note, it's really hard to find.
Is that
some
like
of those
communication?
Yeah, is it?
We have communication notes,
So sometimes I'll see where someone puts the patient's weight in a log note, and I'm like, why would you do that?
And
now I'm going to have to go through the whole thing and look for it. So I think there are a lot of little things that go into that difference. It's not just, and the fact that they're residents.
Because I think it's like we're moving into a new system, so these are like glitches that we'll find on the way, and with time we'll like soften things, smoothing things out, but it's like it's a transition, so that's why we should be
look at it systematically.
Yes.
That's a big area of interest, actually.
And then they should be able to walk into a new doctor and say, here it is, stick it in their computer. It should just populate the screen, but it's not going to do that. Not right now.
I was very surprised that doctor in the ER at Washington Hospital Center found a USB port where he could actually plug that in.
Well, there might be exceptions for it.
No, we don't do it either. I was surprised.
Data entry is coming to the provider. That data has to be in the system.
I think with the standard medication, I think it's a bit difficult to have prescribed the drugs to the patients and not have entered it. In terms of maybe minimum criteria, that's exactly what happened. But in terms of minimum, I think in terms of minimum criteria, there's still a slight chance. But I think in terms of medication received, I don't think so.
There's still things we have to be wary that EHR is not set up to the point where you don't have to know. You put 14.9 PID, and it brings up, you prescribe these, this is the checklist, did you do this, did you do that? So then what's the point of going to medical school? And I can just go in and click, and then I can just say, okay, well, you've got PID, and here, take this.
You still have to go to medical school to be able to
identify.
Get your computer ID.
We want to make sure there's congruency between the EHR process and the learning process and the patient care and the PHR. They all have a seamless flow. That it's not one taking over for the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the EHR was really created to help efficiency. Not to replace basic knowledge. I think that the concerning part about your study to me was that it picked up that so many people weren't doing the appropriate care for their standard of care for their patients. Mm-hmm. That's what bothered me the most. Not the fact that you picked it up and you created the post-it. So hopefully next year it'll show that transition helped to plug in that gap. But
and about, you know, before the electronic health record was in, there was a problem with the standard of care, and the quality improvement came in. So actually, there is a problem with knowledge base in terms of what patients need to get.
So the very first study we did, and that's probably kind of universally, she was finding that as we transition from the hospital-based care for PID to just, you know, write a prescription and give it, that the compliance is so low. I mean, 50% was awful. And So they did, as a result of that, many different steps to up it to 91%. I don't know, you know, how many other institutions that are that high. And so then, again, when you institute a new system, you have to look at it again and not be afraid to do that and to publish it so that other people might look at their system and say, whoops, you know, let's look at what's going on. So I think it's in solutions-based and trends.
Yeah, we're technically over time, but nobody's pounding at the door.